All right, well, welcome to the BBE Lecture Series. These talks are sponsored by the Smith Foundation and the Charles Koch Foundation. I'm happy to introduce today Professor Timur Karan, who has been at Duke since 2007. He's an undergraduate at Princeton, got his graduate degrees in economics at Stanford, and then taught at USC. Has made important research contributions in economics, comparative politics, and in economic history, and he's here to talk to us today about why the Middle East is economically less developed.
Thanks, Mike. I'm delighted to be here. So, as Mike said, our topic is that the Middle East is economically underdeveloped. It has had a poor economic record over the past two centuries. And you can see this in these statistics. The per capita income of the Middle East is about a third of that of the OECD. That's the coalition, the Organization of Advanced Industrial Countries. Life expectancy at birth is about 8 years shorter in the Middle East than in the OECD countries. Within the Middle East, there are variations. Turkey is somewhat richer than the other countries, but all of the major components of the region, the Arab League, including the Arab countries in the Middle East and those in North Africa, and Iran and Turkey, stand out as poor performers. This underperformance is a puzzle because in the Middle Ages, the region was advanced by standards of the day. Only China might have been richer, and even that is controversial. Evidence can be seen in the old bazaars of the region, like the one you see on the screen. Here's a street in what was once the world's largest shopping mall. It had more than 4,000 shops under one roof, and it is still in operation. Travelers marveled at the variety of goods traded in this market and at the volume of commerce in it. This is how the same Grand Bazaar looked like around the 17th century. Something must have happened that kept the Middle East from remaining advanced economically. Something must have kept it from generating the transformations that allowed Western Europe to get ahead and lead the world economically and, of course, politically and militarily as well. I'm going to suggest an explanation for this reversal of the Middle East's economic fortune. Of course, I'm not the first to speak on this subject. Most existing explanations for the economic underdevelopment of the Middle East center on misguided state policies. So scholars talk about weak leaders, about bad priorities of past states. They talk about lack of vision on the part of elites. They talk about regulations that kept the private sector from developing. It has been convenient to focus on the state for one simple reason, and that's that the public archives in the Middle East are extremely rich in public documents, state-produced documents, and private archives are practically non-existent. Research driven by convenience of data will distort conclusions in any context. This distortion, however, has been particularly serious in this context, in the context of Middle Eastern history, because historically, Middle Eastern states were shallow states. They provided law and order, and they collected taxes, and they did not do much else. Social services in the Middle East until the 19th century were provided mostly privately through trusts called waqfs, not by local governments as in Europe. Today's Middle Eastern states have huge footprints in the economy. They have huge footprints in production and social services and even commerce, but this is a modern development. its beginnings go back to the 19th century. Not much, even in the 18th century, states were very small in terms of their overall economic activity. An alternative starting point for an explanation for the Middle East underdevelopment is the trajectory of the private sector. Private finance and commerce essentially stagnated during the second millennium. The institutions of the private sector remained more or less fixed. The legal framework within which people borrowed and lent, within which they bought and sold, did not develop as it did in Europe during the second millennium. And it's this institutional stagnation that I'm going to focus on. This stagnation had effects that the region is still, in 2011, trying to recover from. First of all, the Middle East became uncompetitive in global markets as Westerners started benefiting from progressively advanced institutions. Secondly, the same institutional stagnation weakened states of the Middle East vis-a-vis European states. Private sectors of the Middle East could not finance governments as their European counterparts could. So the states of the Middle East had to turn abroad for loans, which set the stage for the colonizations of the 19th and 20th century. So my first task is to explain why in the Middle East the private sector stagnated institutionally. What do we know about the timing of the region's slip into underdevelopment? Well, the 18th and 19th centuries were a time of crisis. Economic weaknesses brought political weaknesses. Massive reforms were then undertaken to jumpstart a catch-up process. It's not controversial that by then the region was poor and clearly underdeveloped vis-a-vis Europe. This perception was shared in the 19th century by peoples of the region, including local leaders. What were the economic weaknesses that were causing so much trouble? The Industrial Revolution was underway in Europe, and it was happening outside of the Middle East. The new industries of the period involved mass production using new technologies. These technologies were being generated in Western Europe, not in China, not in India, and not in the Middle East. This part of the story is quite well known, so I'm not going to say more about it unless you have questions after I finish the lecture. Also critical, however, is that Western Europe took the lead in developing the institutions that enable the exploitation of the technologies of mass production. By the late 18th century, Western Europe was mobilizing the savings of large numbers and channeling these savings into mass production. And it was doing this through stock markets, through banks, and through corporations. Entrepreneurs were pooling the labor and capital of large numbers within indefinitely living companies. Now we take these capabilities for granted, but they posed immense organizational challenges in some parts of the world. In China, in India, in Africa, in Latin America, and certainly the Middle East. The new physical technologies of production were easily transferable. You can carry a steam engine on a ship. If you don't have the raw materials, you can import the raw materials. If you don't know how to operate the steam engine, you can bring in advisors, technicians to help you out. But the institutions that enabled the West to exploit the new physical technologies like this one, those were not so easily transferable. You cannot set up a stock market like the stock markets that already existed in London and Amsterdam and other parts of Europe. You cannot set up a stock market like this overnight. It requires an intricate legal system, and it requires various professions to support the legal system, and of course it requires schools, ultimately requires schools to train the professionals. So as growth took off in the West, the Middle East could import the technologies of industrialization, and there were places where this was tried, but the region lacked the organizational capabilities to use them. That organizational limitations posed a huge handicap for a region was noticed by Middle Eastern leaders in the 19th century. An early Ottoman response was the founding of the very first completely indigenous modern company in the region. Modern in the sense that it would have an indefinite existence and have publicly traded shares. This was the Şirket-i Hayriye Maritime Transportation Company, headquartered in Istanbul. This transportation company was a profit-seeking enterprise. It was meant to be a profit-seeking enterprise, but it was not set up merely to make money. It was intended to serve also as a prototype of a completely new type of company, completely new with respect to the traditional legal system of the Ottoman Empire and the wider Middle East, and in fact the wider Islamic world. This company issued 1,500 shares. Most were bought by dignitaries. The largest shareholder initially was the Ottoman Sultan himself, who was also, of course, the company's patron. Now, why did the Sultan get involved? It's as if the President of the United States made it a priority of his administration to set up a private airline. Okay. By the 1850s, the most dynamic sectors of the Ottoman Empire economy were dominated by permanent and large enterprises. And every single one of these companies was owned by foreigners or by a coalition of foreigners and local minorities, that is, local Christians and Jews. Abdulmejid, the Sultan, felt that it was time for Muslim Turks to begin pooling capital within large and perpetual companies that would be capable of exploiting the technologies that were being developed, in other words, modern industrial technologies. The political leadership was to set an example for the rest of society to follow. Evidently, Ottoman elites of the time were coming to grips with the limitations of the traditional economic institutions of the private sector. Evidently, they had recognized by then that the traditional means of pooling labor and capital within companies were ill-suited to forming the sort of enterprise that prevailed in new sectors such as banking, mass transport, and manufacturing. What were the traditional means of pooling labor and capital? They were simple partnerships formed under Islamic law, which was the law of the land in the Ottoman Empire and the wider Middle East, and had been the law of land ever since the Islam became the dominant religion of the region. These partnerships had not changed form in 1,000 years. I will say more about them in a moment. In modern sectors such as mass manufacturing and mass transportation, successful businesses did not consist of partnerships. It was not possible to compete in modern sectors such as mass transportation through Islamic partnerships that were no different from structurally from the partnerships that existed in the Middle Ages. Why did Abdulmajid single out Muslim Turks for help? This was, of course, an age of spreading nationalism. That explains the Turkish part. The general problem is that the Ottoman Empire's Muslims were having trouble competing through traditional institutions with the local minorities. Primarily in the Ottoman Empire, this would be the Greeks, Armenians, and Jews. These, as I mentioned a moment ago, they were forming alliances with Europeans and benefiting from European institutions. They were coming to dominate the domestic economy. Why were minorities doing this and not Muslims? Under Islamic law, minorities, religious minorities that is, enjoyed choice of law. In other words, the right to do business under rules of their own choice, under a legal system of their own choice. Islam denied Muslims that right. To be a good Muslim was to live under Islamic law, and that required doing business. If you were a merchant, if you were an investment, that required you were required to do to operate under Islamic law. If you had a dispute with someone, you were required to resolve the dispute in an Islamic court. Local Christians and Jews had the option of using their own courts, which they did to an extent in the before modern times. In the modern era, starting in the 18th century, they started using European courts and started operating under European legal systems. And that is what allowed them to get ahead. Muslims had not had, because Islamic law denied choice of law to Muslims, Muslims had not had the opportunity to do business under European laws. The Sultan, having noticed that, was essentially transplanting a European organizational form and signaling to his Muslim subjects that it would be okay for them to use this this organizational form. There's a simple lesson here. If you take away choices from market participants, that can come to haunt you when market circumstances changed. This rule that Muslims do not have choice of law was imposed in the 7th century. It did not become an economic problem until the 18th century, but as modern legal systems developed, as the institutions of the modern economy developed in Europe, it did become a handicap for the region's Muslims. Now, let me relate the leap that Abdulmajid tried to make to the three basic organizational forms that are used in commercial life. In the 1850s, the organizational menu in Middle East commerce was limited to various types of partnerships. These are enterprises that are established for very specific purposes. Every member of a partnership has veto power over decisions, and the shares are not tradable. Sultan Abdulmajid tried to broaden the menu of options by establishing Şirket-i Hayriye as a joint stock company. The ownership of this company was divided into shares, the shares were going to be freely tradable. So Shikyata Haidia was to have a life independent of the lives of individual founders and employees. Most of the world's largest companies, even in the 1850s, and certainly today, are corporations. Unlike a standard joint stock company, a corporation has standing in court. It is a legal person. It can sue as an organization, and it can be sued as an organization. It cannot be dissolved through the will of a single member. Shirkat al-Khayriya was not a corporation. It has one feature of a corporation, but not all. Incorporation under Ottoman law, establishing a corporation under Ottoman law, became possible only in 1908. And it's only in 1908 that elsewhere in the region it became possible to establish a corporation. It's the same year, 1908, that Egypt passed the law of corporations and some indigenous corporations were established then. So how successful was Sultan Abdulmejid's plan to trigger an explosion in large companies owned by Ottoman Muslims? In the short run, he was not successful at all. It took 60 years for the initiative to bear fruit. Up to the early 20th century, almost all of the new publicly traded companies in the Ottoman Empire were founded by foreigners and minorities. Only exceptions were those that were founded under the Sultan's own, Sultan Abdulmejid's own patronage, or the patronage of his successors to set up prototypes. Once a law of corporations was passed, then you see this blue bar graph then, bar here, Muslims start forming corporations and they start entering modern sectors. So the question is, of course, why did it take so long? Why did the Middle East not develop the corporation from within in the first place? In the 19th century, critical complementary institutions were still missing. A law of corporations would have been meaningless in 1850. Only after certain complementary institutions fell in place did it make sense to institute a law of corporations. Now, to explain why complementary institutions were missing, why you couldn't have a law of corporations in the middle of the 19th century, I have to describe and then interpret the long institutional stagnation of the region. And this requires two steps. We have to go back to the Middle Ages so that we can see, understand the legal system under which the private economy operated. And then I need to explain why that legal system, why the medieval legal system of the Middle East stagnated until the 19th century. So let's then step back to the Middle Ages. In the Middle East, 1,000 years ago, commercial enterprises were formed under Islamic partnership law. The emergence of this law was a very important development. People could always do business using their own capital. To operate on a larger scale, they needed to pool resources with others within a partnership. They looked first to the family because family members tend to trust each other. But not everyone has a family member able to supply capital, so every civilization has faced the challenge of promoting trust among non-relatives who stand to gain by pooling labor and capital. Specifically, you have merchants and producers who need capital, and you have potential investors who don't want to do the physical work, like carrying goods to a distant land on a caravan. The challenge is to devise institutions that allow these demanders and suppliers of capital to pool their resources. Islam produced an impressive contract law for the period to regulate partnerships among these groups. The typical partnership combined the labor of a producer or traveling merchant with the capital of a passive investor. An investor simply provided capital for a share of the gains. The profit shares were set in advance. The shares could be unequal. The shares could be contingent on some event. In that respect, Islamic law was quite sophisticated for the time. Suppose the venture involves long-distance trade. The merchant, who's received the capital from the investor, goes off, trades. If all goes well, he comes back with some profits, and they share the profits according to the agreed formula. If disaster strikes along the way and goods are lost in a sea accident or because brigands sack the caravan or something like that, the active worker gets the traveling merchant gets nothing for his labor. That's his loss. The passive investor loses his capital, but he cannot lose anything more. He has what is known in the legal literature, limited liability. Now, around the year 1000, essentially the same partnerships were used throughout the Mediterranean. Italians used a similar partnership form known as the commenda. It's similar, except that it doesn't have all the flexibilities that the Islamic partnership does, but it essentially serves the same purpose. Around that time, I should repeat, the Middle East was not poorer than Europe. This is consistent with the fact that Europe did not, around the year 1000, have superior commercial or financial institutions. We know that the subsequent trajectory was different. Europe's financial and commercial institutions became increasingly sophisticated, while those of the Middle East stagnated. So something else must have differed. Well, what do we know about the size and longevity of Islamic partnerships? I ask this because in the 19th century, this became a huge problem. In the Middle East, the private sector consisted of tiny enterprises that were short-lived, and Europe was forming large corporations that had an indefinite existence. So what do we know about the size and longevity of Islamic partnerships? Islamic law puts no limit on the number of people contributing labor or capital to a partnership, nor does Islamic law restrict how long a partnership can last. In principle, everybody in this room can form an Islamic partnership, with some of us contributing labor, others contributing capital, some of us perhaps contributing both. However, in practice, the number of partners was usually two. In the records, you see, you occasionally come across three-person partnerships, four-person partnerships. Ones that are five, have five or more partners, are quite rare. So these are very, very small enterprises by the standards of a modern enterprise. And the enterprise was typically limited to a single mission. You had an investor in Alexandria, say, who would finance a traveler who would carry goods to Baghdad and then come back. Then they would share the profits. That would be the end of the enterprise. Okay. The pattern that I'm describing endured right up to the 19th century. I can't show you figures for the 19th century, but with a team of students, I've looked at the legal records of the 17th century in Istanbul, which was the commercial center of the Eastern Mediterranean in the 17th century. And here is what the size distribution of partnerships looked like for that period. So the blue bars here refer to the first half of the century, and the red bars refer to the second half. The major takeaway from this data set is that the vast majority of the enterprises involve just two people. Okay, and the vast majority of these involve one provider of capital and one person doing the work. 3-4 person partnerships exist. Number of partnerships with 5 or more members is very small. The largest partnership I came across in a data set containing more than 10,000 records is a 23-person partnership that was formed for a period of 4 months. Okay, so that's the largest. That's your Microsoft or your Bank of America of the period. Tiny, tiny enterprise. Now, there's no trend. The reason I looked at, I separated the first half of the, separated the data into the first half and second half, is to see whether there was a trend. There is no trend during the 17th century toward larger partnerships. You start seeing a trend toward larger partnerships in the 18th century when there's a huge influx of European merchants into the Middle East, but even in the 19th century, the vast majority of the enterprises are very small and short-lived. This is the pattern that the Ottoman Sultan Abdülmecid in the 1850s sees and sets out to change by setting up a prototype. He realizes that you cannot compete with a legal system that allows you to do only this, to form very small companies. You cannot compete in the modern economy. Now, at the end of a partnership, partners can form a new partnership. But a traditional Islamic partnership is not a corporation. I want to emphasize this. It has no legal standing of its own. It has no life of its own. It can be dissolved at any time unilaterally. If you're a member of a partnership, for any reason, you can dissolve it. All you have to do is go to court and dissolve the, say that you're pulling out. At that point, the assets of the partnership would have to be identified and divided among the partners according to the law. If a member of an Islamic partnership dies before the partnership is over, the partnership ends, the assets are liquidated, and the deceased partner's assets are distributed to his heirs. Of course, in a modern firm, this does not happen. If an employee of Microsoft passes away, or a shareholder of Microsoft passes away, the enterprise continues. Now, whether the interrupted business activity resumes, recontracting is possible, this is going to depend on the inheritance system in place. So let's take a look at the Islamic inheritance system to see whether that will give us a clue as to what might have kept the region behind. After the rise of Islam, this was the dominant inheritance system in the region. The Islamic inheritance system reserves 2/3 of any estate for extended relatives. The female share is always half the male share. By medieval standards, this system, despite this feature, this system was quite egalitarian. Many inheritance systems in the Middle Ages denied inheritance rights to females entirely. At least in the Islamic system, females were entitled to a share and they could enforce the law in court. But there was a downside to this egalitarianism. The system made it difficult to keep property intact from one generation to the next. Successful businesses got fragmented after the founder. Children and other heirs, and the heirs, I should point out, included not just members of the nuclear family, but often more distant relatives as well. When the founder of a successful business passed away, his estate typically got fragmented. Now, in principle, the heirs could reconstitute a liquidated business. But there is a catch. The more heirs you have, the higher the cost of reconstituting the business. Therefore, the greater the cost to the members of the enterprise, members of the partnership, of untimely termination. Successful merchants, those with the largest estates, largest commercial operations, they were more likely to have large numbers of heirs. Why? By virtue of their success and by virtue of the fact that Islamic law allows men to take more than one wife, the successful businessmen typically had multiple wives. Okay. Precisely because they were successful and they had many wives, they had many children, because they were wealthy, their children survived disproportionately, they were well-fed, well-cared for, therefore, and this is what matters to us, they had more heirs. I've run into many records of highly successful businessmen who, when they died, had over 20 heirs. In fact, all of the biographies of famous businessmen of the pre-modern era in the Middle East, 18th century, 17th century, saw their estates get fragmented after their death. So the death of a partner was especially problematic if it involved a successful businessman. If premature dissolution was costly, members of partnerships would have tried to reduce the risk. What would they have done? Well, the risk of having premature liquidation rises with the partnership size. The larger the partnership, the greater the probability that someone is going to die during the contract period. So merchants and investors would have minimized this risk by keeping partnerships small. The risk of premature dissolution also rises with the anticipated duration of the partnership mission. So merchants and investors would have, anticipating the risk, they would have limited the duration of the partnerships. I will fund a mission, a commercial mission of yours from City A to City B and back, if it works out and you are still healthy, you still look healthy to me, we will recontract, okay? But we will not contract for a long period. So here's the punchline. They would have formed, because of the risks involved, the risks that are rooted in the inheritance system, they would have formed small and short-lived companies. Now, remember I said the partnership in the Middle Ages, in Western Europe, also, the organizational form available was a partnership very similar to the Islamic partnership. The same risk of premature dissolution existed in Western Europe. Medieval Italian partnerships became null and void if a partner died. But something was different. The inheritance system was different, and that had major consequences over the long run. The Bible does not explicitly specify inheritance rules. So there was vast experimentation in this area. The Quran does specify very explicitly an inheritance system. It's very little of economic consequence in the Quran, but one thing that is there quite explicitly is the inheritance system. Of course, there's a great deal in the Bible that is relevant to inheritance. There are a lot of principles that are relevant to inheritance, but there's nothing specific, certainly nothing as specific as in the Quran. For that reason, in Europe, inheritance systems varied greatly in the Middle Ages across space and over time. Even in a place as small as Moravia or Lower Saxony, you could find multiple inheritance systems. One inheritance system, which became very popular in Northern Europe, in most of England, in Northern France, in the Low Countries, and in Scandinavia, also parts of Germany and parts of Switzerland, one of these is of particular interest to us, and that is primogeniture. That is an inheritance system under which the business falls in its entirety to the oldest son. In places where primogeniture was practiced, that's the northern countries, merchants knew that if one died, the son would take over. They prearranged to have the son take in. The sons of the partners served as apprentices. They learned the business, and they were ready to step in. This system was not necessarily good for older sons who were sent to become ministers, or if they were third sons, they were told to become soldiers or trained to become soldiers. It's not necessarily good for them. It was certainly not good for the daughters who were typically married off. But the system had one advantage. It reduced the risk of terminating a business early. Not that there was no risk. You could have the son, you could have disagreement with the son who replaces the father. But this facilitated continuity over time. Now, why is this difference that I've identified between the regions significant for long-term economic development? Why are partnership size and longevity, why are they so relevant to our basic question, that is, why the Middle East fell behind? Advances in scale and longevity, business scale and longevity, are needed to stimulate the development of more advanced business techniques. As companies grow in size and duration, they start experiencing coordination problems and communication problems that don't exist in small and short-lived companies. Okay? If businesses remain small and short-lived, no need arises for developing advanced forms of business. The challenges don't arise. Let me give you a couple of examples. Consider accounting. Okay, as partnerships grow in membership and members get replaced by new members, sons take the place of fathers, standardized bookkeeping becomes a necessity. People later on have to be able to understand the records, today's records. Okay, so in the West, as business forms evolved, modern accounting developed. In the Middle East, accounting practices did not develop before the 19th century. The need simply didn't arise. Here's another example. Pressures to make shares tradable and to establish stock markets develop only where enterprises become long-lived. No stock markets arose in the Middle East until the 19th century. In short, in Western Europe, institutional innovations fed on themselves. In the Middle East, commercial institutions stagnated. Now, one consequence of the structural stagnation of the Middle East private sector is that it became increasingly uncompetitive in global markets. Commerce between the Middle East and Europe fell under the control of Westerners, and in time, the West was able to industrialize while the Middle East could not. There were also some political consequences. A private sector consisting of atomistic and ephemeral enterprises will not have the political clout of one composed by larger and long-lasting companies. Checks and balances that arose, political checks and balances that arose in Europe did not arise in the Middle East. No democratic discourse arose, or no discourse of democracy arose in the Middle East, because there were no organized constituencies demanding, private constituencies demanding a share of power. Now, based on my introductory remarks, you might ask at this point, wasn't the state shallow and weren't social services provided by trusts? You might ask, were they also atomistic, these companies, these organizations that are providing all social services? Well, the answer is no, and this creates a complication for the argument. The trusts called waqfs had infinite lives, and they could control a lot of assets, but they themselves had economic drawbacks. So I want to, in the final part of my talk, just tell you something about the waqf and tell you why the existence of the waqf did not give the Middle East an alternative starting point for organizational modernization. So, what's a waqf? It's a trust that is founded under Islamic law. It is managed by a trustee who must follow stipulations laid down by the founder. He can't manage the assets as he wishes. It's unincorporated. This trust is not a legal person. It's not self-governing. The endowment is meant to provide a service. So here's a waqf that still exists. This is Al-Azhar in the Al-Azhar Seminary and college. There was a time when it also provided some charitable services. This is in Cairo. There is an endowment consisting of revenue-producing farms and urban real estate that has kept this going for about a millennium. Okay, the arrangement is supposed to last in perpetuity. This type of organization involving assets that are set aside forever to provide a service was the delivery vehicle for functions that in the West were met through corporations. This was the Middle East's alternative to the corporation. Okay. Thus, practically all urban services in the Middle East were provided by waqfs, not by municipalities, not by local governments, as in Europe. Higher education, in fact, all education was provided through waqfs in the Middle East. In the counterparts to the educational waqfs in the Middle East were corporations in Europe. So the early European colleges were established as corporations, whereas the Middle Eastern colleges were established as waqfs. Traditionally, a huge variety of services were provided by waqfs. The institution of the waqf permitted individuals to supply, in a decentralized manner, public goods that are now supplied by governments. And in some respects, this was a magnificent system. Precisely because of its lack of centralized control, this system was responsive to local needs. Go to the region, and practically all of the old buildings you see, buildings still standing, were established by waqfs. The exceptions are palaces that were established by monarchs and military buildings that were also established by monarchs, like fortresses. But you will see fountains like this were established as waqfs. And an enormous amount of wealth flowed into these waqfs. By the 18th century, depending on the part of the Middle East, between half and between a quarter and half of all real estate was controlled by waqfs. Okay, all of these waqfs were established privately by individuals who set aside resources to provide a particular social service in perpetuity. I'll show you a few more examples quickly. This is a picture from old Istanbul. You have a school here, several hundred years old, was established as a waqf. There's a bathhouse here, bathhouse for men, bathhouse for women, also established as a waqf. There's the corner of a mosque here that was established through yet another waqf. And this park here is an ancient park, with the exception of this fountain here, that was also established and supported for many hundreds of years by a waqf. Here's another example, an inn for merchants, the caravans. This is located on the Silk Road. On the Silk Road, there are hundreds of inns, fortified inns like this. These were established by individuals to supply, to promote commerce, to make it safe to trade along the Silk Road. So the waqf was an immensely important institution economically. It happens that the traditional waqf is not among Islam's original institutions. The earliest evidence of its existence is from about a century after the birth of Islam, the 8th century. So this is an innovation. You have to ask, what prompted this innovation? Private property was insecure. You had very strong empires who preyed on subjects, who took away people's property arbitrarily, taxed arbitrarily, and arbitrary taxation and expropriation threatened, among others, high officials. These officials did what wealthy people do everywhere, including the United States today. They looked for an institution to serve as a wealth shelter. They used the basic idea of trust that was found in earlier civilizations, in Roman law, in Persian law, among other legal systems, to develop the waqf. Let me quickly point out through this timeline that the period when the waqf emerges coincides with the period when the earliest corporations emerge in Europe. The earliest corporations in Europe emerged not in commerce. The first business corporations were established in the 1600s. The first corporations were guilds, religious orders, and cities. And it's in this same period that Europe starts establishing corporations. These ideas, the idea of the corporation and the idea of the trust, both exist in Justinian's code. That's the Roman legal code, or the most advanced Roman legal code. Two civilizations that borrow a great deal from Roman civilization happen to borrow here different institutions, and that has immense consequences over time. The choices made in the Middle Ages to provide many social services through corporations, churches, for example, organizes corporations, educational institutions organizes corporations, versus the same services organized as waqfs. These two civilizations make different choices that contribute to the economic divergence that leaves the Middle East behind. So, why did assets become more secure? Why did they get sheltered when they were endowed as a waqf? Regardless of the service that it provided, whether the service was education or religious service, a mosque, or a charitable service, or a shelter for merchants, the waqf was considered sacred. And it was common knowledge, or at least it became common knowledge between the 8th and 10th centuries, that this was widely believed. Consequently, rulers were reluctant to expropriate waqf assets. If they faced a crisis, they needed resources, they went after private property first and only as a last resort, and taking a risk of being characterized as impious, would they touch waqf assets. So property owners endowed waqfs to protect the assets, okay, to lower the probability of seeing those assets being confiscated or taxed arbitrarily. Now, you're probably wondering if a founder's goal is to shelter assets for his own use, what does he gain by putting those resources into a WACF that is meant to provide a certain service? See two other services here provided by a WACF. There's a bridge connected to a road system that was supported by a WACF, and there's another mosque there also supported by a WACF. What would you gain as a private wealth owner from putting a lot of money into building a big mosque like this or building a road system? Well, it was considered a pious act, so you obtained inner satisfaction and social prestige. But inner satisfaction and social prestige wouldn't account for half of all the real estate in a country being put into these organizations being devoted to charity. There had to be significant material returns to the founder, and in fact there were. The founder of a WACF could appoint himself or herself as the WACF's trustee for life, or he could appoint a friend or a relative. As the founder of the WACF, he enjoyed various benefits. He could set the trustee's salary, which meant that he could actually set up a WACF with a very high salary for the trustee and then appoint himself as the trustee. He could designate also his successor, and often he chose a child. Remember, the inheritance system, Islam has a very rigid inheritance system that requires a person's estate to be divided among members of the family. Well, this is a way the WACF offers a way to circumvent the inheritance system. So in setting up a WACF, a founder didn't simply engage in charity. Some of the secured income accrued to him, his family, and his descendants, but there was a quid pro quo. In return, he accepted certain social responsibilities. So the assets that he put aside as a WACF partly served as a personal wealth shelter, as a wealth shelter for himself and his family and his descendants, and partly they were used to provide a service to society. Now, I've covered these details, and I'm coming to the end of my story, to shed additional light on why traditional economic institutions, the traditional economic institutions that the Middle East used to pool labor and preserve capital were not suited to a modern economy. The WACFs held massive amounts of property, so any account of what went wrong economically and politically in the Middle East must address the role of WACFs. The WACF has one key property of the corporation, which, remember, doesn't exist as an institution under Islamic law. It has an existence apart from its individual trustees and employees and beneficiaries, so it might have provided a starting point for corporate life. However, unlike a corporation, it is not meant to be self-governing. The WACF's objectives and rules of operation are set by the founder. They cannot be changed, and they are enforced by the Islamic court system. Consequently, the WACF system locked resources into unproductive uses. A WACF set up to provide lodging for merchants on the Silk Road, say, could not adjust, at least could not adjust quickly, if trade routes changed and the inns were no longer needed. And I haven't given you a hypothetical example. Many of the inns that were set up on the Silk Road after Africa was circumnavigated and trade routes changed, not as much of the transit trade through between India and Western Europe and between China and Western Europe passed through the Middle East, and these inns were no longer useful. They still continued, the families that were running them and controlled the assets continued to keep some of these open for centuries. Okay, they basically waited there for the merchants who would never come. Those assets could not be transferred, at least not legally, could not be transferred to some more useful endeavor. Now, because of its wealth sheltering, another problem with the Waqf, because of its wealth sheltering function, the Waqf sucked capital out of the commercial sector. Successful merchants invariably set up Waqfs to give their families security. And in the process, they moved capital out of a sector where growing enterprises might have looked for organizational innovations into a relatively inflexible sector. Okay, so they held back, the Waqf sector held back the development of commerce by reducing the amount of capital available. Now, I've given you an organizational argument for why the Middle East fell behind. Notice that I have not invoked attitudes toward innovation. I have not suggested, as many people do these days, that the Middle East is underdeveloped because Islam is a conservative religion. The region was not opposed to innovation per se, and adaptations did occur. If we had time, I could tell you about many things that that changed during the second millennium. However, and this is critical, during the second millennium, the innovations occurred mostly outside the private economic sector. There was a lot of dynamism in the state sector. There was a lot of dynamism in the military. But over the second millennium, there was almost no dynamism in private commerce and private finance. Government organization went through many changes. The tax system evolved. Muslim clerics went along with some of these changes, even with changes in the tax system that involved violations of Quranic principles. Okay, this is evidence that Islamic institutions are not inherently static and clerics are not consistently conservative. Commercial laws and techniques remain stagnant because private merchants and investors, until quite late, lacked reasons to demand the sorts of changes that led to modern organizational forms. And although the state got reorganized, and reorganized repeatedly, the purpose was to consolidate the power of the ruler, not to bind the ruler. So let me recapitulate my last slide. The question has been why, as late as the 19th century, the Middle East had no long-lasting and self-governing private organizations. This was a basic problem in the region in the 19th century, something that was holding it back. This had become a cause of economic underdevelopment. It set the pattern that we observe today. And Sultan Abdulmajid tried to break a vicious circle. My explanation has had two key components: the Islamic inheritance law, along with Islam's marriage laws, helped to keep partnerships small, and this limited pressures for organizational innovation. And secondly, Waqf served the institutional role in the Middle East that corporations served in the West. Many people had a vested interest in the continuation of the Waqf system. I didn't go through the details there, but I'd certainly elaborate. The Waqfs were static institutions, and they also sucked capital out of the commercial sector. Jointly, these institutions kept the Middle East from developing modern economic institutions from within. These modern institutions that did not develop in the Middle East had to be borrowed from abroad, which they were starting in the 19th century and in the continuing in the 20th century, and the reform process is far from over. Thank you.